Lesson 11 concerns Abraham's journeys. You'll recall that earlier in the sessions, I spoke of how his actual physical journeys from place to place reflected a metaphor of his spiritual journeys. And as we trace his physical journeys, it will also correspond in part to his spiritual highs and his spiritual lows. In order to appreciate the journeys recounted in chapters 12, 13, and 14, we want to remember that there is the covenant promises God made to Abraham, chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. We've referred to that passage a number of times, but we have not really anchored our focal study in that passage, and we want to do so today. So if you'll look at with me in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, I'll discuss it, but recalling that in chapter 11, verse 27, we have the catchphrase that says, this is the account or genealogy of Terah. And then it begins to talk about Terah's family and prominently Abram, who is later going to be named Abraham in chapter 17. There are two things that you'll want to keep in mind as you read chapters 12 through 14, and really beyond. The first is found in verse 30. Now Sarai, this is Abram's wife, was barren. She had no children. And then the second thing concerns Lot. In verse 31, we learn that Terah, the patriarch of the clan, took his son Abram and then his grandson Lot, who will be recognized as the nephew of Abram. And he will continue with Abram into Canaan. Keeping those two items in mind then, we come to the call of Abram. Here we have the promises. You'll remember that Abraham journeyed from Ur in the Chaldees, the regions that is south Iraq, south of ancient Babylon. And he went under the leadership of his father Terah and the Terah clan to Haran, which is in southeast Turkey. The travel from Ur to Haran, which is also very close to the border of Syria, is about 600 miles. And that's the context then for understanding this commissioning of Abraham, the promises in this covenant commitment that God has made to Abraham. The travels that we will find from Haran into the central portion of Canaan, ancient Canaan, is about 400 miles. So let's remember now that as we're tracing the journeys of Abram, we start in chapter 12, verse 1, where it says, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. On an earlier occasion, I mentioned how we have the culmination of Abraham's spiritual journey in chapter 22, where similarly you have the language of God instructing Abraham to sojourn, to go to the land of Moriah, and there offer up his son, his only son of promise, and that he will show him where to go. So that's the language of chapter 12, verse 1. And those are the bookends of the Abraham journey spiritually. So let's look then at the promises. First, we have leave your country to the land. That is the first promise. He's going to provide for him a land. Abraham does not know where he is going. Abraham, just by faith, relies upon the spoken word of God. He really doesn't have a map other than this very important point, and that is the map that God will show him. And notice the loss, the movement away from the backstop in his life, the comfort zone. First, he is to leave the land that he knows and has come to know in Haran. And then it speaks of your people. That is a reference to his clan. And then your father's household. That would be the Terah family. So these three concentric circles. The wider one is the land. The next is the clan. And then third, the closest to him, his own immediate household. Then we have I will in verse 2. There's a series of I will, emphasizing that this is initiated by God and he's the one who will carry this out. So it's a one-way promise. God is making these promises to Abraham. It's not dependent upon promise, rather Abraham, other than the fact that he responds and by traveling to this unknown land, he shows that he has faith, he has received the word from the Lord and has placed his faith in it. I will make you into a great nation. Now that presupposes, of course, a population. Doesn't sound very promising, does it, given that his wife is barren and she had no children? So right there, we have to understand that God is making a promise of a land he doesn't see and of a progeny he has yet to see. He goes on to say in verse 2, and I will bless you. Blessing here in Genesis refers to a progeny and also prosperity or wealth. And while it's speaking of the actual physical material wealth of Abraham, it has a spiritual subtext because blessing has to do with God's favor. And Abraham will learn through the various ways that he encounters God, that God has in mind for him a blessing that transcends time and space. It's a spiritual blessing. This is spoken of in the New Testament in chapter 11, where it speaks of how Abraham believed God, and by faith he was looking for a city not built with human hands, but erected by God. So we have these three promises, a land, a people, and then prosperity. The prosperity dimension must not be understood. If you're going to have a nation that's going to impact other nations, that nation must expand and grow in progeny and also in sufficient wealth to sustain a nation of people. Then we see that in verse 2, God says, I will make your name great. What's in view here is that God, in again the various ways that Abraham intersects with other people groups, will come to have an international reputation. And the consequence of that is that he will be able to influence other people groups and show them the love of God and who is the one true God of Abraham and his family, so that they too might enter into the blessing that God has promised for all peoples. Continuing the last phrase, and you will be a blessing. Now here we have a pivot on the part of the promises. We're moving from Abraham the man to the outside, turning himself outside to all people groups. So that's how he's going to be a funnel, a means by which God will bring blessing to all peoples. Verse 3 explains that the way in which all peoples will enter into this blessing is dependent upon their relationship to Abraham, which is tantamount to saying their relationship to Abraham's God, the one true God of Israel. So, the first, I will bless those who bless you. See, that is a right relationship with Abraham. That is someone who favors Abraham. That's someone who enters into peaceful relationship with Abraham. That's someone who enjoys the favor of Abraham's God. And it goes on to say in the opposite way, and whoever curses you, I will curse. Curse here has to do with not a magical incantation, but rather curse here is the opposite of bless, and that is the rejection of Abraham. And in doing so, rejection of his God. In that ancient environment, if you have someone who is opposed to you, then it may well be, and typically was, a hostile relationship. And then here is the conclusion, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. This follows on the Table of Nations in chapter 10 and the Tower of Babel. Babel, you recall, is the attempt on the part of the united gathered peoples to usurp the authority of God, to make a name for themselves, a reputation. And because of their fear of dispersal, they huddled together, championing in their pride their technological advancements in building the Tower of Babel and the city of Babylon. But God intervened because the promise has to do with spreading and exercising territorial and terrestrial rule over the earth. So they must spread in order to enter the blessing. So he confuses their speech. They are dispersed. And now we have a hurdle to be overcome by the peoples because of the confusion of their language. But God's antidote to this is to create a new nation by calling and enabling Abraham to create the nation of Israel. And so that is why Israel is going to be a blessing. This is the way in which God will unfold his promissory purposes and blessings of salvation for all peoples. This then is setting us up for now the travels of Abraham and his journey. Verse 4 is really a striking verse that could be easily overlooked, and that is because it just simply says, so Abram left. But that is the same word in the Hebrew Bible that is found in chapter 12, verse 1, where it says, leave. Abram left. showing immediately that Abraham exhibited a strong, up-and-running faith in God's word. So it says in verse 4 that he left as the Lord had told him, and Lot with him. Abram was 75 years old. Now that's an important detail as well, because we will learn that there will be another 25 years before he will have his son named Isaac, who will be the legitimate recipient of the blessing that has been promised to Abraham. So during these 25 years, Abraham will see the years passing by, slipping by, and yet there is no promised seed in accord with God's will and purpose. Now, Abraham will have some suggestions on how to circumvent this original promise and blessing, and we will see how this works itself out. Now, when Abram entered into the land, we have a description beginning in verse 6 at the various sites that he went to. Shechem is mentioned first. Shechem is about 35 miles north of Jerusalem. There he built an altar to the Lord. It is highly suggested that wherever he went, this was his pattern. He would take up residence near a city. He would then build an altar to the Lord and worship the Lord. Again, a sign of his faith and trust in God, and that God is going to provide for him, that God is going to protect him in this hostile region. Then we find that he goes to Bethel. Bethel and Ai, we don't know where to identify Ai exactly, but it must be close to Bethel, which is about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. And there again, builds an altar, worships the Lord. When we come to chapter 12, and we are looking at verse 10, notice that it says that there was a famine in the land. This is the reason for his departure from the land of promise, going to Egypt. Egypt was the breadbasket of the ancient Near East. Egypt had a more predictable way through the Nile to produce foodstuffs. And so we know that in Genesis there are occasions where famine is found. And Israel's fathers descended into Egypt. And as they descended into Egypt, they would move through the Negev, that's mentioned in verse 9, which is a word for the south, and this is a wilderness area. Then they would enter into Egypt and buy food for them. Now, famine was not unusual in Canaan, because of the many times small rain and also small amounts of rain, and also there would be pestilence, and together there would be real challenge for peoples to sustain themselves in the land. Now, notice it says that he went down to Egypt in verse 10. Chapter 13, verse 1, begins a new episode, and it says in verse 1, so Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, and he's going to retrace his steps. When we look at Abram's travels in the event in Egypt, we will find a remarkable parallel, and this must be intentional on the part of the author of Hebrews, that There is a famine also during the time of Jacob's family, the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. And there is Joseph, who is sold into slavery in Egypt, rises to a great influential position in Pharaoh's household, and is able to receive Jacob and his brothers and provide for them a place. We are told in chapter 15 that some 400 years later that Jacob's descendants fall into slavery under the heavy hand of Pharaoh, and that God sends Moses to bring them out and to deliver them. And in doing so, the people of Egypt are, after 10 plagues, are so wanting these Hebrew people to leave that they provide for them gold and silver. And so we will find the same taking place here, that when you have the departure of Abraham and his family, that he will be empowered and enriched by Pharaoh. My point is that when the people of Israel read these early stories about their ancestors, they could see themselves in these stories, that there is a connection between the God of their ancestors and their own God, who is delivering them and enabling them to enter into the land of promise. Well, what's at work here is that there was in the ancient Near East a respect for a man's wife. And there was a moral code that a ruler or a man would not take illicitly the wife of another man. So in order to remedy that problem, they would murder the husband, leaving the woman to be freed for marriage, to take her as a wife. Now, Abraham knew this so very well, and when we read chapter 20, where Abraham again commits the same strategy by claiming his wife Sarah to be his sister, we are told there, Abraham speaking to Abimelech, this time the king of the Philistines at Gerar, that this was his habit, this was his practice. So we don't have just these two occasions in chapter 12 and 20, but out of pure fear for his life, he played the ruling monarch of the area, in this case Pharaoh, by claiming that Sarai is his sister. Well, there's an attraction to Pharaoh because of her beauty, and he adds her to his harem. Now, when it comes to a harem, we certainly think of many wives, many sexual partners. And in our culture today, we are often given to, well, this must be for sexual reasons preeminently. Well, yes, there can be no question that there is a desire for sexual relations, a form of hedonism, but it was to build up the reputation and strength of the king's household by gathering in a harem and having many offspring through the women of the harem. And also we know that there was a desire on the part of ruling figures to marry important daughters and others of those in the courts of other kings, other monarchs, other wealthy noblemen. So that is at work here. The threat immediately that comes to your mind is if Sarah in this harem becomes pregnant, then the question will be raised, who is the father? And it will compromise the promise that God has made to Abraham, which, as we will come to see, is a miraculous work on the part of God in the life of Abraham and Sarai, and all is to be attributed to the power of God and his elective love for Abraham and beyond, as we saw that Abraham is going to be a witness, a vehicle of God's blessing for all people groups. So it is threatening the promises that God has for Abraham and the plan that he has for seeing all peoples come to receive the blessing. So in order to prohibit this from taking place, verse 17, but the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh. Precisely what that is, we don't know. It is in some way interrupting the normal course of sexual relations. And this would have been true with Sarah in the harem of Pharaoh. This, of course, would be, have been catastrophic because legacy, passing on a dynasty's legacy would be of central importance in the mind of Pharaoh and for the nation of Egypt at large. Well, he learns of this deception, and so he challenges Abraham as to why he would deceive him in this way. When we come to chapter 20, we will discover that in this parallel account, Abimelech, king of the Philistines at Gerar, he has a dream and God appears to him and forewarns him of taking Sarah into his harem. So could this have happened to Egypt? We don't know with certainty, but may well have been. Then the response of Pharaoh is to expel him. Now, in the process of taking Sarai from Abram, he enriches Abram. He enriches him with monetary wealth and also with other things such as the cattle and such. And so he's expelled. Now, what a sad commentary now on Abraham, who had started so strongly in his faith, so strongly in his worship, so strongly resisting the past of polytheism and Ur and Haran and all of the polytheism that characterized the ancient Near East and Canaan and also in Egypt. He resisted all of that. And yet here we have him stumbling because the promise says that whoever you bless, blesses you will be blessed. Whoever curses you will be cursed. Well, transparently, this is a rejection of Abraham. It is a curse against Abraham and his God. Then in chapter 13, we move to Abraham and Lot. Lot accompanied Abraham, and he too became a very wealthy person. Note it says in verse 2 that Abraham had become very wealthy in livestock, silver, and gold. And I take it that is what he received from Pharaoh. And also Lot becomes very wealthy. But there is tension between the uncle and nephew relationship. And this has to do with the abundance of the prosperity that each receives. And so there is a quarrel that ensues over rights of land and of feeding their many multiplying flocks and cattle. And so we are told in verse 7 of chapter 13, "And quarreling arose between Abram's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot." Then we have this supplementary information. The Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. We are told of this already in chapter 12, verse 6. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Why reference who is inhabiting the land? Well, because it is a hostile environment. And there is a dependence on Abraham, by Abraham, on God to protect him. And so it is self-defeating for a family to split and have internal friction when there are around them potential threats by the Canaanites and the Perizzites. We know something about the Canaanites. The Perizzites, we know next to nothing. And there are a number of people groups that will be mentioned along the way, and some of them we know and others we don't. The point is that they are depending upon the Lord to sustain them. Now, Abram, I think, has learned something from his Egyptian experience, because in an act of great mercy and grace and largesse, he says to the younger Lot, he says, "Let's don't quarrel. You can have your choice of any section of land that you wish." And so we find with Lot a contrast with the gracious response of Abraham to the quarreling, because he does take up Abraham on his offer and chooses the best land for himself. And so we begin to read in verse 10, "Lot looked around, saw the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar." This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And we will learn of the details of this destruction on the part of God because of the iniquity, wickedness, unbelievable wickedness. It will be reminiscent of what occurred that brought about the flood. In this case, it's going to be God raining down fire and destruction on the cities of the plain. The cities of the plain were five cities closely connected, and two of these, Sodom and Gomorrah, were the most notable. Now, what we have here is a reference to the beauty and provision of God that took place in the garden, and also how Egypt itself was a land of great prosperity and provision with its foodstuffs. But reference here to what is going to take place in Sodom, and that Lot chose to live within their environment, under their influence, forewarns us as readers that Lot is concerning himself with his own benefit and prosperity. When you read the Apostle Paul that speaks of greed, he says in Colossians chapter 3 that those who have become Christians must put off the old life style, the old man, and take up the new life in Christ Jesus, the new man. And in describing the wickedness of the old man, he refers to greed, and he identifies it as idolatry. Lot was a very greedy person who will fall somewhat under the spell of the great wealth and prosperity of the cities of the plain. And it is identified as idolatry. Who is the idol? Lot himself. His idolatry is altogether selfish, self-serving, and self-centered. And horrors of horrors, when we consider that God has called Abraham and Abraham's legacy to worship God, not the idols, not the false gods, but the one true God who's promised blessing and protection. Here, Lot seizes upon the opportunity for self-aggrandizement. As it turns out, God says to Abram, "Now, Abram, I want to assure you again that my promises are going to come to pass." And so he entreats Abram to go on a walking tour of the land and see that this land will be ultimately his land as promised and his immediate descendants. So he says, "Now, I'm going to bless you with a population that is so great that it's so great you can't count them, and they will be like the dust of the soil." So he says in 17, "Go walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you." This says to me, by virtue of this walking tour, that Abraham is symbolically taking into account, by faith, a claim on the land. And so we find that God will reaffirm his promises progressively as Abraham will become closer and closer to God. He is in a school of spiritual training. He is in the school of learning to place his faith more certainly, more deeply, more devotedly. Now, when we were speaking of Abraham and Lot, you see that there is a separation within the family of Abraham. Separations are an important idea, a motif that runs through all of Genesis, and for that matter, the whole Pentateuch. It begins in the creation account, where divisions and separations occur between the heavens and the earth, and then, of course, the sky and the earth and the waters and the earth. And then we find there is a separation between Cain and his brother Seth. There are the Cainites and the Sethites. Unfortunately, they intermingle and produce a most wicked generation. Noah and his three sons are preserved, and then there's a separation of the three sons and their legacies described for us in chapter 10. Then we find in this case a separation of Abraham from his clan and household, Terah. Lot accompanies him, and then there's another separation taking place. Just like the genealogies in chapters 5 and 11 were designed to differentiate the righteous lineage, the lineage through whom would come the promises of a deliverer found in chapter 3, verse 15, made to Eve, whose offspring will do battle and achieve victory over the offspring of the serpent. We find that these separations are narrowing on that lineage that will produce the deliverer. So now, if we think through Genesis, we will remember that there is a separation that takes place between the two sons of Abraham, Ishmael, born first, and then Isaac, the son of promise. Then the twins born to Isaac, Esau and Jacob. And there is a separation. And then when it comes to Joseph, he is for a season separated from his brothers because he's sold into slavery in Egypt. And there is, at this point, a uniting of the 12 for survival. That's the way Genesis ends. But as you read through the remainder of the Torah, the people reading Genesis would understand this. Because at their time, there would be the opposition to them by people groups who emerged from Abraham's relatives, their own relatives. For example, with Ishmael, you have the Arab tribes. With Esau, you have the Edomites. With Lot's two sons, you have the Ammonites and also the Moabites. So this is distinguishing the lineage of promise and is distinguishing the family through whom would come the promise. And the people of Israel then, as they entered into Canaan and as they came across the various heights, they are forewarned and instructed, beware of the idolatry, the polytheism, the wickedness, the sexual perversions that take place among the Canaanite people groups, and remained holy, to remain pure, remain devoted to God in order to maintain their livelihood in the land. So that's what we have in mind of the separations that's beginning to take place very clearly in chapter 13. Now we're going to turn to chapter 14. This is where Abram truly becomes an international figure. And this is because of this story pertaining to two kings that are highlighted. There is an eastern coalition of kings who raided the west, and its coalition in the west included the king of Sodom. And the eastern coalition overwhelmed the southern, or rather western coalition, and took the bounty of the peoples of the western coalition. And that included Lot and his family, all of his servants, his wealth, and all that pertaining to it. This is described then in a detail because of the importance of what will occur. And it begins in verse 1, runs all the way through verse 12, which reads in verse 12, they also carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. Verse 13 distinguishes Abram's ethnicity for the first time. Ethnicity is very important in this chapter. The various people groups associated with their nations and city-states are showing us that Abraham, because of his role in rescuing Lot, his role in his relationship to the king of Sodom as an equal player on the international board, that he was a very important figure who will now become increasingly a figure of influence, and he can exercise that influence for the purpose that God has enriched him to be. When it comes to the word Hebrew occurring here, we do not know exactly what the meaning of Hebrew is. There are two proposals. One is the ancestor named in the Shemite genealogy of chapter 11 of Eber, E-B-E-R, Eber. No, you have a very close sound to the Hebrew word for Hebrew, Ivri, Eber, Ivri. And so some have thought that Abraham was named Ivri because of that connection with the ancestor Eber. The other is that it comes from the root word meaning to cross over. And it has the idea of a traveler that's crossing boundaries. And we know that on future occasions we'll recognize that, in fact, Abraham identifies himself as a sojourner, a migrant. Another use of the word Hebrew is not ethnicity, but it is used by non-Israelites, non-Hebrew people. In Genesis, non-Hebrew people. It refers, for example, to Joseph as a Hebrew. And this is a usage that we find not only in Genesis, but also in the books of Samuel, having a social use. So it can refer to people who are on the outside of civil authorities, fugitives, outlaws. Essentially, I think the idea is, in terms of their economic social status, people who are outsiders. But the point is here that Abram is ethnically differentiated from others who are in his own circle of camaraderie. So it does mention the Amorite named Mamre. But Abram brings together his group and they race after this eastern coalition of kings, catch them in the far north in the city of Dan, and there recover, we're told, in verse 16, that he recovered all the goods, brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. Mention is made in verse 14, Dan. Now, actually, Dan has not been born yet. This is one of the sons of Jacob, and Jacob hasn't been born yet. This is one of those evidences that there's been an editor who has updated place names for people reading it at a later time with a better understanding of the various locations. Well, bursting onto the scene unexpected in the story of the kings, in addition to King Sodom, is this king of Jerusalem. And so we learn that Melchizedek is the king of Salem, meaning Jerusalem. He brought out bread and wine. I'm looking at verse 18. And he worshiped the God Most High, El Elyon, the God Most High. And he blessed Abram. Now, of course, that's an immediate echo of what we found in chapter 12, where he blessed Abram. And we spoke of how this would then be an opportunity for Abram in turn to bless Melchizedek. And so we read this blessing spoken over Abraham. But it is a blessing directed toward Abraham's God. And he's identified as creator of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, again, Elyon, who delivered your enemies into your hand. Now here is the blessing that Abram gives to him, that is Melchizedek, a tenth part to Melchizedek. This would have been readily recognized by the people in Mosaic times as giving a tenth part of their resources to the tabernacle priesthood for their use in carrying out worship. And so that, in a foreshadowing way, speaks of Abram, who did the same, recognizing that Melchizedek is a king and also a priest, we are told in verse 18, who worshiped the same God as Abram. This was not a Hebrew person. This was a person, probably a Canaanite, we can say, who is worshiping the one true God of Abraham. What a happy moment it must have been in the life of Abraham to, in all of this paganism, sexual perversion, idolatry, widespread wickedness, would meet someone who has a genuine love and heart for the same God as Abram and has a love and a heart for Abraham. Now, notice that this is using a generic form of God, El, E-L, Elyon, E-L-Y-O-N. It's not the personal name of God, Yahweh, but it is, he is identified as Yahweh in verse 22. When Abram meets the king of Sodom, Abram swears an oath, I have raised my hand to the Lord. See, that's Yahweh, who is God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you. Now, he received from Melchizedek the bread and the wine and the blessing. But when it came to the pagan, Sodom, he resisted it. He would not accept and receive from the king of Sodom. And why is this? He explains it in verse 23. That is, he would not have Sodom say, I have enriched Abraham. Rather, Abram is going to want it said that it is Abraham's God who has enriched him. And so there is an acceptance of Melchizedek, but he refuses the booty and the bounty, trusting God. Now the men who were with him, named in the coalition that went with Abram, they can receive their share as it should be, but not Abram. He rejects it. When it comes to Melchizedek, the writer to the Hebrews seizes on the mysterious failure of Melchizedek. And this is described for us in Hebrews chapter 7, verses 1 through 4. Next time when we come together, we're going to be looking at the explanation, the development of the idea of covenant, chapters 15, 16, and 17. This is really the heart of the Abraham story, and we will give focus attention in what occurs in chapters 15 and 17. But before we introduce that section, I'm going to pause and talk about this figure, Melchizedek, who is a very mysterious figure, one that is mentioned in Psalm 110, and then the writer to Hebrews in the New Testament speaks of him, Melchizedek, and speaks of him in the context of our Lord Jesus Christ. And we can learn much about Christ by a focused study on Melchizedek, found in chapters 5, 6, and 7. But especially we want to look at Hebrews chapter 7, verses 1 through 4.